The White House has enlisted McDonald's to help promote vaccines. From We Can Do This coffee cups to messages on its Times Square billboard, the fast food giant will help the Biden administration spread the word. And it's time to check in with Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin, about news from the local housing market, including a look at where homes are selling the fastest.
For context, in the city of Chicago, homes sold in an average of 91 days in the first quarter of the year. In Westlawn, they sold in an average of 36 days.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Thursday, May 13th. When it comes to a professional like your doctor or lawyer, you want someone who knows you well. Wintrust believes you should have the same relationship with your banker, someone you can call directly and know they'll understand your concerns. Thousands of local business owners called their Wintrust banker when they needed Paycheck Protection Program loans. They called, Wintrust answered, and helped more than 11,000 local businesses secure funding. Learn more at wintrust.com/dailygist. Member FDIC. Hi there, and welcome to Crane's Daily Gist Live, brought to you by Wintrust. I'm Amy Guth, and I'm joined, as I am every week, by Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin. Hello, Dennis. How's it going?
Good morning, Amy. It's going great. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. Let's start with a story that I could have killed you because the headline put a song in my head for days. And it's about homes selling fast everywhere. But in the story, you said, here is where they're selling like grease lightning. And I walked around for hours like hydromatic. Come on, Dennis.
Let's see you do your John Travolta. Let's see it right here and now.
I don't know that I have a John Travolta impersonation, but I'll work on it for next week.
I was honestly surprised that more people didn't make John Travolta comments when I put that story on Twitter. Homes are selling fast everywhere. You and I have discussed that extensively. Using the first quarter data published by the Chicago Association of Realtors, I looked for where they're selling fastest. For context, in the city of Chicago, homes sold in an average of 91 days in the first quarter of the year. In Westlawn, they sold in an average of 36 days. So one, that's an average. Two, that doesn't even include the homes that never go on the market, that go on private listing networks or sell between friends. As we've discussed, that's a much more common thing right now. But they're selling in 36 days. And in fact, when I called a couple of agents, I called them in Westlawn and Clearing and Ashburn, in those two other neighborhoods, they're selling in an average of 39 days. But when I called a couple of agents in Westlawn at 36 days, they said, yeah, that kind of seems slow to me. Because what they were seeing was houses selling in 5 days. The example that absolutely killed me, I don't think I've ever seen this before. Real estate agent lists a house. He's got so much traffic, so many bids coming in, that he jacks up the price by 10% to slow down traffic. And as he said, to weed out the non-serious buyers, to basically say there's now a higher floor. So he jacks up the price by 10% after just a couple days, and it sells even higher. It sold for a total of 18% above the original asking price, and it was under contract. I think it was in like 6 days. Now I don't recall, but in less than a week. And this is a very common experience now in Westlawn and Clearing and Ashburn and Joliet. We have a list, as you know, of the 11 places. It should be 10, but there was a tie, where homes are selling fastest in the city and suburbs. It includes the ones I just named and Streamwood, Oaklawn, the Round Lake area. Most of these are low to moderate priced places where buyers are more likely to be sensitive to interest rate changes. The lower the interest rate, the more house I can buy. If I'm buying a $3 million house, I'm not quite as concerned about interest rates. It also is a place where probably there are a lot of people who are converting from renting to owning because interest rates are so low that ownership becomes a lot cheaper than renting. And ownership is often what I would prefer to do anyway, if I can afford it. So in these 11 places, we mostly find, as I said, low and moderate price places where you're getting nice bungalows and really great houses. We're not talking about backwaters. We're not talking about rundown homes. We're talking about nice middle-class homes selling like greased lightning.
There it is again. Just when it gets out of my head, you put the song right back in my head. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah. All right, let's move our attention to Pilsen. We have talked a lot about Pilsen and gentrification. There have been some anti-gentrification measures, but some demolitions have resumed. Tell me what's going on in Pilsen.
These three buildings on 18th Street in a row are the first to apply for demolition permits under that new surcharge. In March, the city council passed a new set of ordinances, one of which has an anti-gentrification surcharge on demolitions in Pilsen and on the western portion of the 606. You pay $15,000 per demolition as a surcharge. That money goes into an affordable housing program. The idea is, if you're going to go ahead and demolish, if you're going to go ahead and very likely displace people out of what was lower cost housing, then you need to contribute to this affordable housing program. These three buildings attached in a row on 18th Street, immediately west of the 18th Street Pink Line stop, were going to be demolished in 2019. And that was when the city had this landmarking plan. We've talked about this. The previous mayoral administration was trying a thing where several hundred buildings in Pilsen would be landmarked, which would prevent demolitions. But there were reasons that people opposed that. A new alderman and then a new mayor come in, and the new plan replacing that landmarking plan was this package of anti-gentrification ordinances. Well, when the landmarking plan was being discussed, the Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez, negotiated with these building owners to not demolish them. They were going to demolish, build a four-story building with new apartments in them. They said, okay, then we will rehab the buildings. They never did rehab. Now the new ordinance is in effect, and this is the first applicant under that $15,000 surcharge. It's a $45,000 surcharge for them because it's three buildings. They wouldn't talk to me, not too surprised. But what the alderman said is, well, you know, okay, so they went back on their word, but the benefit to the community is $45,000 toward affordable housing. The loss to the community would be these lower income apartments that were on the second floor. I don't know how many. According to the Cook County Assessor, there are 17 apartments in those three buildings. That seems unlikely. I was at the buildings and I tried to count the mailboxes, but that didn't work. So I don't really know how many apartments are there, but they will be gone. And there will now be a four-story build, or what will be built there will be a four-story building with retail on the first floor and certainly higher end than these apartments on the upper floors.
Interesting. Shifting again, another neighborhood, let's head to Wicker Park to talk about another kind of contentious issue. And that in particular is a lawsuit. It's dibs, but it's not the shoveling kind that gets me ranting all winter.
Yeah, exactly. And it caught my eye because it looked, I assumed when I first saw the lawsuit that there had to be snow involved, but there's not. It's a complex thing that I had to sort of trick out in the story, but basically six unit building built with five parking spaces, which is not uncommon. And the developer of the building owned two units. So he deeded one parking space to those two units. Then he loses the two units in separate foreclosure actions, separated by several years. But each of the two units is sold with a deed that says you get parking space five. So we both think we own parking space five. The person who bought one of the units out of foreclosure then gets the HOA, the homeowners association, to say, no, that parking space goes with this guy's unit. And then there's this sort of calendar issue because that decision is made within a few days of the court determining or of the court selling the other unit at foreclosure. It becomes very complicated. But now, 3 years later, the two unit owners are fighting in court over title to that parking space. Each of those condos is operated as a rental, and the owner of the earlier unit, the one that the homeowners association says gets the unit, said that once all this started, all this legal battle started, he had to tell his tenants to stop parking in the unit, which means he has to charge them less rent. So it's costing him about $150 a month. Either of the units, when sold, if the other unit has the parking space, would sell for less than it might, because parking space is at a premium everywhere, and certainly in Wicker Park. So there is something riding on this dibs suit, but it doesn't have to do with like an old lawn chair stuck out in the street.
For once. It doesn't have to do with the ironing board out on the street. But nonetheless, exactly. It sounds exasperating. If you are living in that building and kind of dealing with that, if you're that owner, that sounds like a very exasperating issue.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And the renters, too, must think, well, wait a minute. I rented an apartment that had a parking space. And I'm sure that in each case they've explained, well, we've got this issue. But yeah, it does seem. And like I said in the story, most dibs battles go away when the snow melts. But this one's been going on for 3 years and doesn't show any sign of stopping anytime soon. It was thrown back into the court just 2 weeks ago.
We'll have to follow on this one because that sounds like I'm curious to see how that shakes out. All right. Yeah. We have a lot of houses to talk about. So let's get into that. Let's start with one that is like meditation in house form. Modernist architect Tony Grunsfeld designed this house for a couple who wanted to live with nature all around. I'm going to say he succeeded in that. Tell me about this place.
He did. Tony Grunsfeld was a great architect, died in 2011, built a lot of modernist homes, primarily on the North Shore. And this couple, when they were empty nesters in Northbrook, wanted to use Tony Grunsfeld because they'd been in some of his houses. They bought a site right at the lip of a ravine in Highland Park. And when you look at their view, you look at some of those photos, you can see that the view goes down into the ravine and back up. I mean, we don't see a lot of topography in Chicago, but if you live on the ravines on the North Shore, you get some. In this picture, you can tell. He put the house is really probably as close to the edge of the ravine as it can be, and it's nearly all glass in the back. So, for instance, here in this breakfast room, all you've got in your sight is trees. And Grunsfeld was sort of he was a modernist and he did very minimal designs. And that really works in a setting like this where you don't want anything to compete with the trees and plants and foxes and raccoons and everything else. And they even on the roof, they have a pad for a telescope because they're near but not on Lake Michigan and they're in this wooded area. So they go up on the roof and look at the stars. It's a great setting.
Yeah. And so beautiful. I mean, just looking at the pictures of this place, it's so calming looking. And they have a lot of kind of natural colors in the decor, but you don't need much. You know, you wouldn't want to compete with the outside and put like really splashy, bright colors in this place.
Yeah, I would hate to see the next person decide to compete with the surroundings outside, but you can't account for anybody's style. This is the front of the house. This is a very typical sort of Tony Grunsfeld exterior. It's sort of hard-edged modernism, but you can see the curves. You can kind of tell that the walls round in toward the glass. And then there's that glass turret, that round turret, which contains the stairs, including those stairs up to the rooftop telescope pad. But this is what you see when you come in from the street. Everything else, virtually every room in the house looks in the other direction out into that ravine. And it's really, it's a very tranquil place, which was their goal. So here you've walked in the front door and boom, trees everywhere. I mean, they shot it at the ideal time, right? The trees are in their spring green, which is so lush. They're not yet really dense. But the other time, had they been selling at a different time, would be with the fall colors. I mean, imagine the fall colors of those leaves with these walnut floors. It would feel like it was one continuous floor.
And so they're putting it up for sale just under $4 million.
Yeah. They built it in about 2001, and they're older. They're in their 70s. The house has an elevator, but even so, they said, you know, this is too much house for us in our 70s. But it's not too much house for you, Amy. I think you should go grab it.
Oh, I'll just do that as soon as we finish up here. No problem.
You should. It's not even on the market. We just published it today, and it doesn't go on the market till tomorrow. So rush over there.
I have a feeling this is another one that will be snapped up quickly.
I think we probably will. Again, this is by Tony Grunsfeld. And over the course of the past few years, I have covered some, but not all, of the Grunsfeld houses that have gone on the market on the North Shore. And they tend to sell fast. I had a list of them going for a story that we ended up having. I had to do a different story and we never published it. But they were selling on the average in just a few weeks compared to a month or more in the North Shore suburbs they were in. Because, I mean, he was a brand name on the North Shore in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And you can see why. I mean, his houses are really remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of architects, we also have a Frank Lloyd Wright to talk about. This one's in Glenview, and it's going to be auctioned. We have talked about this one before, I'm pretty sure.
We have, yeah, just last fall when it came on the market. It actually, so I first wrote about it in 2014. It has been, it was built in 1950. It's been in one family's hands since 1965. Essentially, nobody really knew about it because it was never on tours or anything like that. They had been very quiet about it. It's on a street called Portage Run, which is in a wooded area of Glenview, right next to the Grove, which many people know, which is a historic site with woods and prairies and a natural history. And so they had kind of kept it quiet. It wasn't really known that it was there. So the headline we put on the story when I first went out to see it in 2014 was, "You think you know all the Frank Lloyd Wright houses? You didn't know this one." Because at that time, the woman who, with her husband, had bought it in 1965, was looking at selling it. She was in her 70s and he had already died. She was looking at selling it. Well, she ended up deciding to live out her life there, so it didn't come on the market. She died in early 2020 and her son put it on the market in the fall of 2020. It is such a remarkable place. It's what you see there is not only Frank Lloyd Wright. He built the main wing of the house and then in 1950, and then in 1965, when this woman and her husband bought it, he was a commercial architect, and he designed an extension with some more bedrooms. But he used the same materials, he used the same lines, and so it's this very low-lying house surrounded by 150-year-old trees. It's really, really wonderful, and there's a pool in the back. One of the interesting things about the house is that Frank Lloyd Wright did these textile cutouts. They're kind of a strange shape, and it's hard to tell, but when you look, you realize they're leaf shapes. What he has done is basically cut out the shape of a leaf and pasted it to the wall, and also cut out the shape of leaves from other walls. So it's a very stylized sort of a thing he was messing around with at that time, 1950. But look at this roof. This too is ceiling, I should say. This too is walnut, and it's as if you're under this giant tree canopy, and that runs the entire length of the living spaces, the kitchen, that is hanging overhead, which, you know, some people today might find a little oppressive. It's a little heavy, but it also is, I mean, it's as Frank Lloyd Wright as it gets.
Yeah, I mean, it does have kind of a treehouse feel. Another house that does a good job. And this one has a lot less glass than the last one we were looking at, but still kind of brings nature in, especially with that natural wood overhead. You really feel like you're just kind of in this continual space that's very natural.
You are. And there's a continuation from inside to outside. So I, as I said, I was last in the house in 2014, but it left a very strong impression because of what it is. And that overhanging roof, in the one photo, we saw the long wall of windows with the overhanging roof. That wall of windows and the overhanging roof, you can see that the roof extends out over. That's a walkway outside. So the inside living room really does extend to the outside. And the time I was there, it was raining. And so it was like being in a rainforest because you're protected by the tree canopy, but it's raining all around you.
All right. Another house, also with a prominent architect attached to it. This one is in Kenwood, and it just looks like a vacation to Italy.
It does. It really does. It's by Benjamin Marshall, who designed the Blackstone Hotel and many other hotels downtown, mansions, several buildings along East Lakeshore Drive, very well known as sort of a society architect in the early part of the 20th century. This is built in the late part of the 19th century, 1899. He's pretty young. And he builds this palazzo that I think I said in a tweet looks like it's from Lake Como, not the one in Wisconsin, but the one in Italy. It's got it's got this, you know, limestone palazzo exterior, and then you come in to this is what you arrive at. So it's 1899. We're very wealthy. We're society people. We're going to entertain our friends in our ballroom on the top floor. So they come in the front door, come to this space, go up that staircase, which has these swirly handrails, and there's marble and wood around, all around. They go up three stories to the ballroom, which is the size of the full second floor, the entire third floor has a domed roof above it, windows all around. That domed roof is now painted sort of a midnight blue, and the windows, so you can just imagine, it's 1899. The university isn't in Kenwood yet, or isn't as big as it is in Hyde Park yet. A lot of fancy people are building really nice houses nearby. And we go up to my ballroom, and from those windows, we can look out at all of that. We can look at Lake Michigan. We can look toward downtown, which of course doesn't have the Willis Tower to see all the way from Kenwood in 1899, but we can probably see that distance. It would have been a very grand place to be. This is the ballroom with the windows all around. It would be a very grand home.
Really beautiful house. It's interesting. You can absolutely see details from the South Shore Cultural Center and the Blackstone Hotel. You can see them in this house so much.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I forgot to mention the South Shore Cultural Center, once the South Shore Country Club. Yes, also by Benjamin Marshall. I mean, some of our grandest old buildings are by Marshall, and this is certainly one of our grandest old houses.
The asking price is $2.7 million. It's six bedroom, 7,500 square feet on Ellis Avenue, and it faces 49th Street. Came on the market May 4th.
Thank you. As I age increasingly and lose more memory, can I just have you follow me around and say all the things I don't remember?
Sure, as long as I can like fill in blanks just randomly. Just fill in details. All right, let's shift now and talk about some houses with very specific owners. The first one, let's talk about a house formerly of John Wayne Gacy.
So just to be very clear, this is not John Wayne Gacy's house. This is the site where John Wayne Gacy's house was. His house was demolished in the wake of police finding the remains of 29 human beings in his crawl space, in his garage, in his yard. So the house is no longer there. This house, built in the mid-80s, built in 1988, about a decade after the police investigation, has been for sale since 2019 and sold quietly in April. I did get confirmation from the buyer's brother that he is the buyer of the house. The buyer's brother said that the buyer hadn't really known about the Gacy connection and probably would not comment to me further. But there is hardly a more notorious site in the Chicago area than this. There's also where H.H. Holmes killed some people in Englewood, but one of the things is nobody really knows how many people he killed there, and he also killed in other cities in Texas and in Canada and in Philadelphia. John Wayne Gacy, unfortunately, did a lot of it right from this location. The remains of 29 of his victims were found on this property, and it's quite a gruesome history. What else do you do with the property? His family, Gacy's family, lost the site in a sheriff's sale. They had unpaid taxes. I mean, I think they were basically washing their hands of the property. And it sat vacant for quite a while. And then the new house was built on the site in 1988. It has now, I believe it has had three owners, the ones who built it in 1988, who, according to a Tribune story I found, knew what had happened on the site. They sold it in 2004. I've never been able to reach those owners because they owned it through a land trust that concealed their names. And then those 2004 buyers sold it in April to somebody who, as I said, his brother claims he didn't know the history of the site.
Even though new house, old one was torn down, I feel like that would just be tricky. If you're that realtor, right? That's a little tricky to have that conversation. And then you'd feel like weird to not say it too, right? There's a lot going on there.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if, when you buy a house, when you sell a house, there are disclosures you have to fill out, asbestos and flood water and things like that. There is not a disclosure form for human remains. But generally, I think if I were the agent, I think I would feel I had to say it.
For sure.
In October of 2019, when I tried to reach this agent, he didn't respond. He was not listed as the selling agent, so I don't know if he was still attached at the time that it sold. I don't know if it sold privately. But you imagine, I mean, somebody's got to have this conversation.
If not, how awkward to be the neighbor and go, "Hi, person who just moved in here. Hope you know about..." Yep. "Welcome to the neighborhood." Ugh. Okay, two other houses with people of note who live in them. One owned by a reality TV winner and a Fox 32 anchor in Riverside. Also kind of a modern take on a Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yes, exactly. A modern take on a Frank Lloyd Wright. It's a nice big house. It's got these, you can see the prairie detailing outside and inside. It has a huge amount of wood trim. It was purchased by Ed Swiderski, who won season 5 of The Bachelorette, but did not go on to marry the Bachelorette. He later was on Bachelor, The Bachelor, and he was also on Bachelor Pad. He is no longer a bachelor. He married Natalie Bomke, who's an anchor on Channel 32 on Fox 32 here in Chicago. And they sold a house in Logan Square in December and bought this. Really, it's a very nice house. And Riverside, I think we've talked about Riverside. Anybody who hasn't gone and looked at Riverside, do that this weekend. It is one of the prettiest suburbs of Chicago. It was designed to be beautiful, and it is. And this, many of the houses are far older than this. But this has, as I mentioned, all this banded wood trim, which is out of that prairie style, but a modern take on it. Has that barrel vaulted ceiling over the hallway. It's a nice house. They paid about $900,000, I think $950,000 for this house.
I feel like we've talked about Riverside quite a bit. Riverside and River Woods, I think we've talked like so many like interesting houses that really have a lot of natural elements in them and that yes. are very like stately looking and very, you know, statement kind of houses.
Yeah, absolutely. Two very different places. Riverside is southwest of the city. River Woods is mostly north. I guess you could call it northwest. They're both on the Des Plaines River. Riverside developed began developing right at about the time of the Great Chicago Fire, 1871. River Woods started developing in the 1950s and has a lot of mid-century modern homes. It was supposed to be sort of a great new mid-century location. But yeah, they both, you know, they both take advantage of what makes Chicago great, our winding rivers and beautiful tall trees. They do feel similar, though built in different eras. Another good point by you, Amy. Thank you very much.
I'll be your spokesperson. That's it. I'll just be the official Dennis Radkin spokesperson. There's no way I'll screw that up. It'll be fine.
I should start. I'm getting you on the payroll tomorrow.
Done. Mission accomplished. Great. All right. What's coming up in the week ahead, Dennis?
A couple of things. I have some new data on home equity, how home equity has grown in the first quarter of the year. The market has been so strong everywhere, not only in Chicago. And we're going to look at, you know, we have for years, we've been the place with the most underwater homeowners. And at one point we had more underwater homeowners than New York and Los Angeles combined. I think that was in like 2017, 18, when we were moving very slowly. Our market is rising so fast. There's going to be a real question of like how many of us have come up from underwater, which I think would be very valuable to us to have more people come up from underwater, because if I'm not underwater, it's easier for me to put my house on the market, because I don't have to bring money to the table when I close. And that might help ease some of our problem with too little inventory being on the market.
Indeed. All right. Well, we'll talk about that next week. Thanks so much, Dennis. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up in today's top stories, a Loop office building goes back on the market after a 2019 deal fell apart. We'll talk about that and more right after this. Here's a great way to stay in touch with Crane's Daily Gist. Subscribe to the Crane's Morning 10. It's our daily newsletter featuring the 10 biggest stories of the day. To subscribe, visit chicagobusiness.com/morning10.
This is the Crane's Daily Gist
with Amy Guth.
The Biden administration has sought the help of McDonald's for its multi-million dollar vaccine awareness campaign called We Can Do This. Crane's sister publication Ad Age reports that McDonald's will dedicate inventory on its Times Square billboard to the effort, and starting in July will feature the campaign's slogan on coffee cups and on materials used for delivery. The campaign messaging aims to send people to vaccines.gov, which includes a tool to help people find information as well as find out where they can get vaccinated. The campaign run by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services comes as the vaccination rate falls from a peak last month. The nationwide average is now about 2 million vaccines per day, according to government data, down from about 3.4 million per day in mid-April. The Joffrey Ballet plans to open a studio and training center in the South Loop this fall. The Joffrey bought a 5,300 plus square foot retail portion of a condo building at 1920 South Wabash, and this location will offer classes from the Joffrey Academy's Children's Division, Youth Division, and Adult Open Division involving ballet, jazz, hip hop, modern dance, and tap. The move is part of the organization's 5-year so-called Joffrey for All strategic plan. The headquarters will stay at 10 East Randolph, and its new performance space will still be at the Lyric Opera House on Wacker. The expansion to the South Loop was funded largely by Joffrey director Richard Holson and his wife Sherry, along with Guarantee Trust Life Insurance and ITW. That according to a spokesperson for Joffrey. Alderman Pat Dowell, who represents the South Loop, said she's excited about the possibilities the organization will bring to the area. Michael Fasnacht, the former advertising executive who's been serving as interim head of World Business Chicago since January, will be the permanent president and CEO while continuing his job as the city's chief marketing officer. In a statement, he said, quote, "I look forward to continuing to serve the city of Chicago by supporting an equitable and inclusive recovery. Continuing, Chicago should become a role model for any global large city of how to enable and drive economic growth for all its residents." A.D. Quigg is reporting the story in detail for Cranes.
Michael Fasnacht got tapped to serve as the city's first chief marketing officer in April of 2020, just as COVID was starting to surge. He was an ad executive for several years at FCB and planned to leverage his skills to help guide the city's public health messaging, get pro bono ad work from city firms, and help steer Chicago's COVID recovery. But less than a year in, the mayor asked him to serve as the head of World Business Chicago, on top of his marketing duties. That's the city's nonprofit public-private partnership designed to lure businesses to the city. Fasnacht took over when the last CEO, Andrea Zopp, left to go work at a venture capital firm. Officials said they'd launch a national search for Zopp's replacement, but are instead sticking with Fasnacht. He'll work double duty, continuing as the city's marketing officer and serving as World Business Chicago's permanent president and CEO. Besides bolstering world business revenues that have fallen in recent years, the city also has the task of rebuilding its tourism arm, Choose Chicago. They're slated to be without a CEO later this summer.
Find more detail on this story and many others at chicagobusiness.com. More than 2 years after a deal to sell the office building at 200 West Jackson Boulevard fell apart, the owners of the Loop property, a joint venture of Chicago-based White Oak Realty Partners and New York-based Angelo Gordon, are trying again, hiring the Chicago office of Cushman & Wakefield to sell the 29-story tower. Danny Ecker is reporting the story for Cranes.
Now that companies are starting to call workers back to offices, likely at some point this summer or fall, and the vaccination count keeps growing, downtown office landlords are finally getting back to trying to sell their buildings, especially if they wanted to last year and couldn't. 200 West Jackson is the third big Loop office building to hit the market over the past few weeks. And this is one that might look pretty attractive to investors that want cash flow and a pretty full building. It's 94% leased. And we're going to learn a little bit from this sales process and those of some other office buildings on LaSalle Street nearby that are for sale about how investors feel about the future of the Central Loop as an office destination. That's now an interesting question with so much of the leasing activity in the West Loop and Fulton Market and some big buildings in the Loop that will soon have a lot of vacant space.
And that's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Our continuous news feed lives at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to our guest today, Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin. Be sure to subscribe to these conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your audio on demand. And find hashtag Crane's Daily Gist on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And let's continue talking there about these and other business stories. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.